Welcome to Love Nature, the Biophilia Podcast, a product of the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences. Now here are your hosts, Dr. Eric Dorfman and Dr. Dan Dombrowski.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Love Nature, the Biophilia Podcast. I am your special guest host, Chris Smith. You know me as the host of Science Tonight at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences, or maybe play trivia with me on Tuesday nights as Quizmaster Chris. Today, I am here to talk to you about the hosts of this podcast. You've been hearing their voices for the last several weeks. Dan Dombrowski and Eric Dorfman are here. We are going to investigate the wonders of the natural world through their eyes today. So let's bring them onto the show. Dr. Eric Dorfman, you know him. He's the director of the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences.
Hi, Chris.
And Dr. Dan Dombrowski is the chief veterinarian at the museum. Dan, good to talk to you.
Hey, Chris. Good to talk to you, too.
I'm excited to talk to you because listening to the podcast, getting a sense for the kinds of themes that the two of you like to go over, the guests that you have on the show, I think this is a great opportunity to dive into what interests you two and really why you wanted to have this medium and get these themes and messages out there and how they relate to the work that the museum does.
Our museum is fundamentally about the concept of biophilia. We do a lot of really great science, really deep looks at all kinds of things from ecology to collection-based research to genomics. And this generates a lot of really important scientific information. And then on the other side, we invite guests into the museum. We engage them with the stories that stem from the research that we do, and we get them excited about science and nature. And that's really what biophilia is in concept, the connection of humanity to other forms of life. We sort of unpack that every day at the museum. So I love doing podcasts. It's a really exciting and satisfying medium for me because we bring people onto the show. We talk to them about what makes them tick. And it's over time giving us an opportunity to connect with a group of people all around the world who are interested in the same things we are. And that's connect to them as guests, but also our listening base, which is growing very nicely, I must say.
I agree. I think the podcast has been an adventure for me. This is my first time working on a podcast, and so it's really given me an opportunity to bring a lot of what I do at our museum. As Eric said, we really are all about biophilia and sort of that love for nature and understanding wildlife and wild places and bringing that to people or guests at the museum. And so the podcast has been a great way to kind of package that. I get to spend time talking to Eric, learning about him and his background and things that he's done. We bring on guests that really enable us to explore things that I'm excited about. For me, every time, it's like me listening to the podcast myself. I get to meet these guests and ask great questions. And I love that, you know, so far, every one of our guests, I feel this connection where through this conversation and through the podcast, we seem to get to this end where it's like, what an opportunity to have a positive discussion and talk about science and facts and really feel good. And at the end of the day, even though we come from different places and have different backgrounds, it's amazing how the message ends up being just how much we love nature and talking about these things and teaching people and bringing it to our guests.
And of course, our interviewees have taught us a lot as we've gone on too.
Absolutely.
Isn't it? I mean, it's been fascinating for us to get to know the folks that we have on. Their perspectives have always really been very stimulating.
Absolutely. And I think we've had an opportunity to bring a group of diverse guests in that have different angles. Some are in science and sort of deep into research. Others are really have a global perspective on, you know, conservation and wild places. I look forward to more and more guests to talk about other ways that biophilia impacts or touches our lives.
So then let's dive in a little bit and talk about the ways that biophilia has impacted your perspectives and how you bring your expertise and experiences into the show. So, Eric, give us a little bit of your sciencey past.
My sciencey past. Well, I went to University of California, San Diego, where I studied ecology, behavior, and evolution, and music, actually. And that
I didn't know that.
That's yeah, did you not? Oh, right. Yes. I actually sang opera amazingly. Wow. I did.
All right. We've got a new topic. Go ahead.
All right, we'll bring an opera singer on. Yeah, I'll only do it in the shower nowadays. But it sounds great. Anyway, so I was at UC San Diego studying ecology, behavior, and evolution, and then moved on to do a master's on porpoises in Monterey Bay through Moss Landing Marine Laboratories. Then after that, immigrated to Australia and did my PhD at the University of Sydney, where I looked at cormorants on both the east coast of Australia and the outback. I moved from there to South Africa to do a postdoc and then back to Australia to the top end of the country to work on storks in Kakadu National Park and other areas of northeastern Australia. Thing I also worked on egrets on the Great Barrier Reef, and that was also a really magnificent opportunity and time. Every time I went to one of these places, the magnificence of the natural world around me really spoke so deeply to who I am. I realize that even though I was working as an ecologist and very interested in the data that I was collecting and writing it up as a scientist, there was always this real love of nature and the inspiration that I got. And I think many scientists feel this way, that I got from being in the natural world and just being amongst it. And it was interesting too, because that work I mentioned on the Great Barrier Reef on these egrets, this was the first species that I actually witnessed in decline over the years that I was studying it. And so there were two colors, there are two color phases, a gray and a white, just like panthers and leopards. They can be born out of the same nest. But for reasons that are too complicated to go on here, the white ones were all disappearing. And I realized that I really needed to go into conservation, that this was a major motivation for me to think about and work with species that are in trouble. And of course, in the years intervening, more and more species have become in trouble, which isn't a great thing, but at least it's the work for conservation biologists is not going to go away anywhere. And that really kind of led me to thinking about how conservation decisions are made. And mostly they're made by legislators or by the public and public motivation rather than exclusively on scientific data. And that really led me to thinking about museums and how do we do the good work that we do through influencing the public on the way to preserve the natural world. And part of the way we do that is through the heart, through reaching minds, through unlocking the heart and emotions. And for me personally, I couldn't have a better career than working in a museum because we have this left brain, right brain balance between the two. And it gets right back to the idea of biophilia, because that's a concept that really personally speaks to me, and I think many people, as well as being an interesting academic topic.
So, Dan, I actually find, I'm thinking, Dan, that there's a similar through line for you as a veterinarian and the kinds of...
Absolutely.
Like delivering physical care to wildlife or to the live animal collection at the museum. There's similar intellectual challenges and emotions that go behind seeing an egret population in decline and wanting to do something about it in a big way, and also seeing the health and safety of animals. Can you bridge that for me? Am I onto something here?
Yeah. I think as a veterinarian, so I went to vet school here in North Carolina. I actually had been at the museum before deciding that I wanted to go to school and become a veterinarian. And so I was a curator at the museum. I've actually been there since about 1998. So I've been around a long time, kind of in and out of different areas and different functions. But the real connection, starting even before I became a veterinarian at the museum, was the same. I love wildlife. I love the experience. I love the feelings that I have when I'm out in nature. And that might be fishing or hunting or nature hiking, or anytime I learn something new, it just, I love that feeling, and it makes me sort of healthier and happier. And what I love even more is sharing that with other people. And so at the museum, I sort of learned that, you know, there was a place that I could go and share my excitement about nature and about things that are alive and about animals and different species and how they interact. So I sort of started my journey there. From that point, I wanted to learn more about individual animals and about physiology and sort of deeper organismal level biology, and decided to go to vet school. I thought that would be a great way to complement what I knew was important at the museum and what I already like to do with teaching people about nature and science. So fast forward, I spent about 4 years in vet school and ended up back at the museum, bringing sort of this new knowledge or this new perspective with me. And so, just as you said, you know, I work on a level as a veterinarian, on an organismal level, where I look into an individual animal, sometimes a population of animals, and try to understand the science and the biology, the adaptations, the things that make an individual species physiology or anatomy different from another species. And by taking that knowledge and out to the population level, or really the environmental level, and trying to apply what I know or teach other people so they can apply that to management of populations and a protection of environments and understanding the needs of both animals and even ecosystems, sort of from that small piece or element of an individual through medicine and anatomy and physiology up to the bigger picture. And as a veterinarian, even before I was a veterinarian, I thought it would be really cool if the museum went, you know, had a veterinarian or went into that realm and brought that to the table, because I think it really is a great complement for what we do. And it now, I at the museum, I have a clinic where I primarily work with museum animals, but I get to do a lot of wildlife work and research, and all of this can be done with visitors or guests at the museum engaged and watching and talking to us. So we, on one side in our clinic, we have a window. We call it the window in animal health. On one side of the window, we work with students and other veterinarians and researchers and advanced science. On the other side, guests at the museum can look in, and as we're making discoveries, they share that experience with us. And they could be a 5-year-old or a 50-year-old, someone who has a PhD or is a medical doctor, or someone who's never gone to college or maybe didn't finish school. And they all are sort of brought to the same table and get to really contribute, I would say, to the experience. All of them sort of all together to me and with us. And that's what I really love about sort of what I do as a veterinarian and what I do at the museum. It's very, very fulfilling in that way.
That's great stuff. I know people love the window on animal health too when they come to the museum.
It's there's a huge crowd there whenever there's a procedure on, isn't there?
I always say if I didn't work there, I'd probably be outside the window looking in. So
if we zoom back out a little bit, Eric, you decided to take this love of nature, being in nature, turn that into conservation action, and in a way that gets that conservation message out to the most people possible, encouraging connections for them. And you do that through museums. Mm. How did you come to be in the museum field to start with, to go from academic science into the museum world?
Well, I've always jumped back and forth between the museum field and other things. My first role was as a teenager at the California Academy of Sciences in San Francisco, near where I grew up. That was really exciting, feeding the fish. And there was this big aquarium called the Roundabout, a big donut where the big pelagic fish and sharks, which are also fish, were swimming around and diving in there and shoving salmon heads into the sharks' mouths as they swam by. You know, that, I mean, to me at that time, it was just a complete thrill as a young person, being able to connect to animals in a setting where everybody cared about them as much as I did and thinking about their welfare. You know, it was a very simple, my idea of what museums did was very simple. I was there also when they got their first penguins. Going on and pursuing an academic career and then thinking about conservation, Every time I could, I would connect back to museums. So for instance, in graduate school, I volunteered at the University of Sydney. There still is a small museum called the Maclay Museum. It's a really lovely place. I volunteered doing small exhibitions I did one for wetlands, for instance. Also did some work for the aquarium in Sydney, again, a small exhibition on coral reefs. But the more I was involved with it, the more stimulating it came, the more satisfying it became. And so then my first job that was the beginning of my permanent career in museums was at Te Papa, the National Museum of New Zealand. And it's funny because I keep going back to this idea of biophilia. So I ran a unit that took people from exhibitions and connected them to people from science to create all kinds of projects, permanent long-term exhibitions on the relationship of New Zealand nature to its human culture, documentary on conservation of a particular species, computer game, a whole lot of different things that, again, we're really thinking about how to wrestle with this idea of using people's heart to think about conservation. Again, you know, it wasn't a plunge. I waded in ankle deep for a while and hopped out again. But really, after that experience at Te Papa, which taught me so much about museum standards and processes and aesthetics, and also because they're so deeply connected to their Maori population, the indigenous people of New Zealand, that taught me about the standards of how to interact as a museum leader with the cultural owners of an area, which is why I'm so interested in Native Americans here and really connecting deeply in North Carolina to those nations. And of course, thinking about DEAI generally, you know, all of those things really had their roots for me in New Zealand and the experiences that I had there. And I think with anything, and maybe Dan, you feel this way about veterinary work, that once you have a career, it becomes a lens that you think about with everything you do. You know, I remember when I was younger, I used to be into rock climbing. And when I would walk down the street, I'd be looking at, like, can I climb on this building? Can I, could I get up that tree if I were, if, you know? And now the idea behind biophilia, that deep personal connection to nature, does tint everything that I look at, everything that I do.
Yeah, I agree. I is talking about a lens, or a lens that you sort of look at this topic through. I think that's why it's so important to bring folks of different backgrounds and careers and experience and knowledge to the table. You know, we're talking about, I mean, we love these things, but we need to protect them. You know, we're at a point where environmental protections, habitat protections, we've got to find ways to live within our environment. You know, we need solutions. And for that to work, we've got to bring a lot of different people to the table that have their lenses to look at the world in different ways. And honestly, on the podcast, I love that aspect where every guest that comes in has this little different angle, you know, this different lens. And so I get an opportunity, and hopefully the listeners do too, to see nature and see the world through their lens. And every time I do that, it's like I have to step back and rethink about all the things I love through this new angle or new lens. I think that's a great part of this and what we're doing.
As something I want to add, one of the things that we have to do, and if this podcast can be part of that, so much the better, is to make conservation and living sustainably on the planet neither a chore nor a luxury, right? Those are right. The kinds of things. It can't be an inconvenience for people. We've got to share that message about how important it is and how intimately connected it is to our way of life. And that's something, yeah.
It is. It's we're a part of it, and it's needed for our health, for our happiness. And I think the first step, and hopefully through the podcast, just getting people to think about opening their eyes, you know, taking a breath, stepping back, and again, looking at things that are right outside their door in some cases that, you know, they can see in a new way. And through science and research, you know, observation is always the first part. Just watching in vet medicine, the most important thing I do is when I walk in the room and I just look at the animal and watch the animal before I start anything else. And so I'm hoping that's something we can, you know, every podcast, we have a great guest, our listeners hear the podcast, and then they want to go outside and sort of think about things in a new way. And all of a sudden we're on the same page and hopefully want the same things. So
there's a lot more to this interview, but first we have this quick message. Then we'll get back to Chris, Eric, and Dan.
Love Nature, the Biophilia Podcast, is a production of the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences. Each episode explores our connection with nature on a personal, physical, and scientific level that enables us to live better and more responsibly on the planet.
This podcast was made possible by a donation from the Burt's Bees Foundation and Burt's Bees to the Friends of the Museum of Natural Sciences.
Now, on to our interview.
So here's something I'm curious about, Dan. In my work and experience as an environmental educator, museum educator, there are so many different levels of connecting people to science and to nature. And, you know, talking to the two of you right now is a great example of it. Dan, you've got a pine snake in hand in the vet lab, and people see that snake and they see you, and they can immediately draw a connection between themselves and the pine snake in the vet clinic. And then we can take these sort of bigger ideas about nature and conservation and how science is done and what science is, and put them in exhibition halls and in galleries and develop programs. And that's what Eric is overseeing. And that different groups of people bring their own interests and their own life histories and perspectives to each of these different ways to connect. And so we have to find ways to find people where they are, to meet all of the different people who may visit the museum or take in a museum program or go on a nature hike at the different places where they're at. So can you share with us maybe some interesting stories or cases that you've had that you feel like really got to people? Like even through the glass of the vet clinic, you felt like you really had that one-to-one connection.
Absolutely. I would say some of my most impactful, or for me at least, impactful cases and opportunities often involve animals that come to us with the same kinds of problems or issues that either people have themselves or that they've seen in their pets. And so, you know, one thing that as we do well taking care of animals in a collection or in captivity and they live longer, we end up sort of managing older animals and cancer becomes an issue. Even in a turtle, a snake, a fish, we see cancer, and that's part of our work and part of my work as a veterinarian. And so at this window, you know, where people can, we have cameras and microphones and literally people are 3 to 4 feet away from a procedure. That could be a exam or that could be a surgery. And so in a case where we're evaluating a patient or managing a case of cancer in one of our patients, which currently we have a snapping turtle, for example. And just to tell you a little bit sort of the story behind the snapping turtle, it's North Carolina. It's our state's record snapping turtle, largest snapping turtle ever found in North Carolina. It's been at the museum since about 2012.
And folks, it is a beautiful big turtle. You're thinking big turtle, and I'm telling you, it's a big turtle.
Yes, that's a very big turtle.
That's right. It weighs in at about 68 pounds currently. So this is a turtle that came to us. It visits us in our clinic. People get to see us work with this animal. It's had some health issues. This is a turtle that turtles can live a long time. People always ask, how long can a turtle live? Very long is my answer. I would not be surprised to see a musket ball and, you know, somewhere lodged in the shell of this turtle. I mean, it's a very, very old animal. And about a year ago, it came to us with a mass or a lesion or a wound around its jaw or its face. The tomium, that's the beak of a turtle, was impacted by this wound. And we diagnosed cancer in this turtle. And so it's an animal that has a carcinoma. This is a type of cancer, you know, that people get the same types of cells. To learn or to understand about this cancer, we did aspirates. We took samples. We did biopsies, took samples of the tissue. And guests watching these procedures on multiple cases, we've had people come and say, you know, wow, I had to get a biopsy and I have or had cancer and I went through this process. It gives me chills to talk about it. You know, people are like, wow, this is, and so they get to see in a way that maybe nowhere else in the world, they get to watch the process of helping this turtle and managing, first diagnosing its cancer and now managing it. This turtle is actually getting radiation therapy right now, just like other animals or just like people get. And so it's about halfway through its treatments. We're doing our best to provide for the turtle. But for me, those are the really impactful opportunities. When I can sort of break down people's barriers and get them to the point where they're thinking about their lives and wow, that I'm learning from what you're doing and they're applying that back to their own lives. And I think with, in general, with wildlife and wild places, the environment, with nature, that's what I want to do, is I want to get people to where they're not just watching me and sort of excited for me. I want them to become excited themselves and really start to make their own connections and explore how this really is impactful to them. One thing we haven't said about a museum, one of the other things I love, not just about what I do, but our museum is a place where we have collections of specimens of animals to base our science on and to base, basically we have the ability to really back up what we say. And it's a place that, you know, we're not being political. We're not just being opinionated. We're able to show people science in a way that's like, here it is. Here's how we got there. And again, I hope or I think that it brings people with a lot of different backgrounds and understandings together. And hopefully we can do it in a way that they make that connection, no matter who they are, where they've been, or what those sort of opinions or political or cultural backgrounds might be. So
just to add, you know, yeah, we have talked a lot about a lot of the other things that museums do. We haven't talked about collections at all. And that, of course, is the fundamental, those are the sort of building blocks of a natural history museum like ours. Everything is one way or another based on or around collections. And they're an amazing snapshot. I don't know how old our oldest specimen is, at least 67 million years old. But, you know, it's evidence of things that happened in times past, you know, and if this turtle did have a musket ball lodged in its shell somewhere, you know, that would, when the turtle finally passes away, hopefully not for a very long time still to come, maybe if we found a musket ball, it would be stored with the turtle in our collection as part of the evidence of its history. And so that to me is incredibly important, because you can see these nowhere else aside from a museum like ours can you connect to organisms that lived and breathed long, long ago. And why it's so important that this happens is because it gives us evidence of change. You know, one example that I really like is that they looked at, there was a group of researchers who looked at birds' feathers from museum stored specimens, and they found pollutants in the birds' feathers. And they were able to look at what the reigning pollutants were at the time that the bird was collected or found. And so you have all sorts of particulate, and it's capturing that environment and the changes over time. And this is, of course, one of the reasons we need a number of organisms. You can't just have one cardinal in your collection. You need a number of them for changes in time, changes over space, because the kinds of questions that museums ask have to deal with these long-term phenomena.
I agree completely. You know, the idea of these collections and their importance, it applies to health and medicine.
Yes.
Our aspect in medicine. Yes. Mm-hmm. We have diseases, just like, you know, this COVID is a pandemic that's affecting people, and we're in it now, in the middle of it, and really learning as we go. There are diseases that impact other animals and other species. Some affect people, those we call zoonotic diseases. COVID is potentially or is a zoonotic disease, and that it can affect other animals, not just people. Some diseases don't. Sometimes they're not diseases that affect people, but they're devastating to other populations of animals. There's a chytrid fungus, for example, that we've known now for several years is very much a problem with amphibian populations around the globe. It's all over the place. And so, just like you said, with collections, you could go back and look at these feathers to look at what was in the environment as far as pollution. We can go back and evaluate specimens to see where this chytrid fungus first appeared or when it first appeared. And so whether it's for animal and wildlife sake or people's sake, those collections are critical. We don't know the questions yet. And so we've been trusted to be the keepers of these things, whether they're fossils or preserved, you know, specimens. We're sort of charged with keeping these things so that when the questions come up, we can have the material to find the answers. So,
well, that's the key thing too. You know, I was talking a minute ago about how we look at the past through collections, but we're also, just exactly as you said, we're giving future generations the opportunity to ask these really important questions. And we'll hopefully our museum collection, which is numbers in the millions of specimens, will be useful and vital tool for people long after Dan and I are gone, you know, hundreds of years from now, which, oh, of course, we may live that long. We can only hope.
Well, so then, Eric, do museum collections save the world?
You know what I was thinking when you asked that question? It's people who save the world, and it's the questions that we ask. It's the collections themselves are just animals or tissues preserved in a room. But it's actually the inspired scientists who ask the valuable questions and find robust answers that makes it really a critical use. And what I've said this in other contexts, that science is a process. It's not an endpoint. And we're always learning more. And although the initial results may be hard to understand because of the statistics or the technology used to find that material out, a lot of times the fundamental story that comes out of it is really, really important and impactful. So yes, obliquely, collections will save the world, but it's definitely what we do with them that's important.
I want to add too, you know, along those lines, those people or those scientists or future leaders, we don't know who they are yet. And so it's so important for us to reach out and really engage everyone, you know, no matter no matter who they are, the cultures, their backgrounds, their groups, their even political beliefs. It's so important to reach those people so that, you know, we're sort of fishing for those future leaders that are going to save the world.
We're fishing for the children who are the grandparents of the future leaders as well, yeah, right? So we're reaching into the future, which to me is very exciting.
Well, I was going to let that lead into another question, Eric, because you talked about working in lots of different places all around the world, California, Australia, South Africa.
He's a globetrotter.
New Zealand.
A globetrotter.
That's great.
World traveler. And worked with lots of different cultures and communities because of that. So I'm interested to hear about some of your experiences working with, you mentioned the indigenous communities in New Zealand, working in South Africa. I think that's pretty fascinating stuff to have that kind of experience.
I think the thing that mostly it does is teach you humility. There's a story that I don't often recount. My first leadership position was at Whanganui Regional Museum in New Zealand. That was it's important culturally, but not a very big museum. And I had gone not long before from a position at the National Museum, which is also important, but a very big institution. And I mentioned a little bit ago that, you know, it really taught me museum standards and processes, and I'd worked on some major exhibitions. And because I knew how the National Museum interacted with Maori people, I also thought that the museum that I was at would also, you know, that I could bring those lessons immediately to this other culture. And this was, you know, I was months into my first CEO role at a museum. And so I was talking to them about, to a group of delegates from the local Maori tribe, and told them how we would do an exhibition in partnership with them. And to say that they were unimpressed. And what I learned, and you know, it wasn't my first, I had actually been in Australia for many years before, but never in the same sort of leadership position. So, but also had interacted with Aboriginal communities at the top end of the country and kind of felt I knew my way around this. But really, it showed me that relationship, which started off on an interesting foot, blossomed over the next 5 years that I was there to one that was very warm and very deep. And I'm still count those people as some of the most amazing and spiritually wonderful people that I've ever connected to. What it taught me is that no amount of humility is really enough, right? To bring your lessons to the communities that you come to, but be prepared to listen first. And Stephen Covey, an author who I admire immensely, talks about your first motivation should be to listen and to understand. And your second motivation should be then to be understood. And it is the way I've connected. And you mentioned that, and subsequent to that, Chris, you talked about my traveling the world, and I have been very lucky moving from one place to another. And the thing that really, each time I go, it becomes a bit easier to connect to the new community that I'm in, because the rightness of that lesson about listening first really is more ingrained as I go on. So that's probably the biggest lesson that I've learned. There's been so many other things, technical skills and appreciation of nature in certain ways, you know, thinking about feather cloaks and singing and, you know, like song lines and all sorts of things, perspectives on individual species. There's so much that has unpacked as a result of really opening my ears and listening to what these people have had to say.
It strikes me that whether you're working with a group of people, whether you're going on a hike out in nature, whether you're sitting on your apartment balcony getting some fresh air, that stopping for a moment, taking a breath, listening to the world around you can really reset the way you think about the world.
You know, that's such an important point, yes, too. You know, talking about humility with respect to people also extends to being in the wild. You know, there's so much, and wasn't Deja talking about this, about slowing down and letting nature tell you stories?
Right.
So yeah,
I agree. I mean, I think for health, for our levels of stress, for just our happiness, I think it's so important. And if there's one lesson through all this, I think it's, you know, whether, again, it's your apartment and you're stepping out the door and you just listen, you breathe some air, you take a minute to look at the world around you. We're really a part of this world. And I think it's easy for people, because we try to control our environment and we sort of have gotten used to really controlling so many aspects of our smaller world, I think it's easy to forget that, you know, we're a part of nature, the bigger world, the planet, the environment. I mean, we've got to take care of this stuff because it's critical to us. We're one piece in a bigger puzzle. And we have a lot of pull, right? A lot of opportunity to either do well or not so well. And so I think that's really important to get that message out there.
Well, Chris, you must have a perspective on this too, because you are connecting people to all kinds of information about nature on a weekly basis.
One thing that I've learned from being a nature tour guide and doing cave trips in state parks, canoe trips across lakes, or, you know, running trivia game shows for the museum, is that folks, at least folks here in the U.S., I would even get more granular. A lot of the folks that I meet and talk to live right here in the southeastern part of the U.S. So many folks are looking for something fun and interesting to do. And they go to parks, they go on cave trips, they come visit the museum in order to get around other people and to see, hear, or participate in something that breaks them out of their everyday routines.
Yeah.
we might call these leisure activities.
We but might.
Something fun to do.
Yeah.
And for a lot of people, they can find something about a nature center or a museum that is fun, that's interesting, that piques their curiosity, but they don't have to feel so invested in it in that moment.
Interesting.
So that they can enjoy it.
Yeah.
And so when I'm running a trivia game show or talking to guests for a lecture series, something like that, I'm always looking for how we can, I'll say, entertain people to keep their curiosity piqued, keep their interest up so that they continue to participate in these things. And then as we go along, right, the messages that are getting out are things like science is cool. You can do science. Check out all the amazing things about the natural world that we know because of the tools and techniques that scientists use to help us figure out the mysteries of the universe around us. And there's so much interesting stuff. The universe is so vast. There are so many amazing things out there that you can read more about, explore, listen to someone who's passionate about that thing, talk about it. And if we can keep people's interest, then they'll come back for more, right?
Absolutely.
We can activate those reward pathways in the brain that say, you know what, that was fun. Let's go to the museum again next month.
So that's the long game that you're in.
You're right. Well, this is the thing too. It's not, you know, I've been to some of those trivia nights. Those questions are not easy, but it's right? not pure entertainment. That's the thing. It's, no, I won't use the word edutainment. That's terrible. I would never do that. It's not an amusement park. There's an expectation that people will come away somehow with their brain stretched in a certain direction. And that's pretty exciting. And yet it's critical what you do to make it engaging and fun.
And common terminology that I use with colleagues who do similar work to me at the museum, whether they're at zoos, nature centers, museums, historical sites, we talk about provoking people, which can have a slightly negative connotation if you think about it in an aggressive sense, like you're going to provoke a fight.
Right.
But if we can provoke people to think about something, to get their brain engaged first at an emotional level, we can then provide them with information that leads to revelation.
Right.
So we can take advantage of the opportunity or take the opportunity. You know, like you said, folks want a positive experience. They want something fun and exciting to do. And if we can sort of fill that need or what they're looking for at that time with real science and facts. And I love when people come to the museum or come, you know, or attend a program, they had no idea that they were going to learn something or that they were going to sort of come across something that was going to be, you know, they're going to remember this forever. And they walk away from a program having learned that thing, you know, that fact that they're going to go tell their friends. Mm. And to me, I think that's a lot. What I see you do, Chris, and what I think is a great part of our museum and educators that do, you know, sort of programming and teach about nature and wildlife. I love when they sort of get folks your discussion of provoking or off guard, like they didn't even know they were going to learn something. And then it's like, wow, did you know? And they go and tell all their friends. I think that's great.
So looking at the clock, Eric, Pepsi or Coca-Cola?
Oh gosh. Pepsi.
North Carolina made. Good answer.
I'm going to say Pepsi too.
Good answer. All right. Krispy Kreme or Dunkin'?
Krispy Kreme.
Krispy Kreme.
Oh, playing it safe.
No, I grew up. I mean, it's this. I don't know. We'll see where this goes.
But yes, yeah, we are. Because you haven't said Krispy Kreme or bean sprouts. So it's a different.
I don't know. Eric, I thought maybe since your latest charge was Pennsylvania, you may have been more on the Duncan side.
Well, I will say that in Pennsylvania, I have had a cruller or two, but I haven't actually been since I moved down to North Carolina. Sorry, Duncan.
So I'm just going to have to throw this out there just because we're there, but in Hampton, Virginia. So I grew up in Pennsylvania around Pittsburgh until I was about 8 or 9 and then moved to Hampton, Virginia and spent several years there. We had a Krispy Kreme store or, you know, we called it a factory back then, but a Krispy Kreme that field trips as we were growing up in like junior high school were to go see how donuts are made. So,
well, that's exciting.
Yeah.
Especially if you got samples on the way out, you know.
That's right.
Yeah. Everybody got a donut. Bojangles or Chick-fil-A?
Oh, no, I'm going to have to say Chick-fil-A there.
I don't eat chicken, so I'm going to say neither.
Well, like I'll tell you.
Not at all.
I'll tell you why I'm not going to confess, you know, or confirm or deny eating it either. But I do really like the advertising in Chick-fil-A with the cow and the cows painting the ads. That is very clever.
So, I know what we can look forward to on museum billboards now.
So I've got a question then. If you are not eating. Yes, that's right. Museum billboards. What are you having for Thanksgiving dinner, Dan?
Ham.
Oh, okay. So you don't eat chicken. I just went right to being a vegetarian.
No, sorry. I threw that off. Yeah. So just not chicken or turkey, but
oh, right.
We do have ham for Thanksgiving.
All right. Would you eat a goose?
North Carolina connection. I'm not big on
birds. Sort of. You don't
birds
like
and
fowl.
Poultry and fowl. Yeah.
Oh, I mean, right.
It's called fowl for a reason. Somebody misspelled it a long time ago. But
you heard it here, folks.
Yes.
That's going to be the headline for this podcast.
Right.
Dr. Dan Dombrowski says fowl are fowl. All right. Last one. In-N-Out or Cookout?
Now I'm going to embarrass myself because I don't know what Cookout is.
Oh,
are you just talking about Cookout? Is it like a barbecue at home?
Oh,
or is
no.
Is it a thing?
No.
Cookout is a North Carolina staple. Yeah.
See, I'm I've been stuck cookout. In COVID teleworking. I haven't got out often enough. I do know In-N-Out. I can even picture the sign.
You got a field trip.
We have to, right? I have to. Cookout, we're coming to see you. But I'm going to have to say In-N-Out because it's the only one I know. So
at Cookout, you can get a burger with a side of a hot dog or a hot dog with a side of a hot dog.
Wow.
And a milkshake of any flavor you could imagine.
Oh, wow. I mean, that sounds pretty compelling, I have to say. All right. That's definitely a field trip.
All right. I've tallied up the points and Dan wins.
Oh, no.
He wins because of that remark on spelling, doesn't he?
That's it.
Why don't you tell people when they can come in and listen to your various things that you do, Chris? Tell people when the schedule is.
Oh, that's very kind of you. Virtual Trivia Tuesday happens every Tuesday night at 6 p.m. Eastern. You can visit naturalsciences.org and check out the virtual events tab or the museum's Facebook page. Look for our events. Look for Virtual Trivia Tuesday. You have to register to participate, but it is free. I ask 3 rounds of 5 questions each. Everybody gets to submit their own answers on our virtual trivia platform. And we also have a lot of fun.
It is lots of fun, really. It's great. And the questions are not gimmies. They're hard.
I do some serious deep dives on the web for my trivia questions. So everybody walks away learning at least a few things, and you might walk away with a gold medal.
A gold medal.
Nice.
Fantastic.
Virtual gold.
A virtual medal. Virtual gold and virtual medal.
That's it. And then every Thursday night at 7, I host the science talk show, Science Tonight. where we meet interesting people making everyday discoveries in science, technology, engineering, mathematics, and more.
That's at the same link?
That's 7 Eastern on Thursdays. And folks can find Science Tonight at the museum's YouTube channel.
Great.
Just North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences on YouTube. And, of course, naturalsciences.org is a great place to go for all of the kinds of programs that are coming out of the museum, more than just mine. There's amazing events, virtual classrooms that are happening every day of the week out of the museum.
Great.
Thanks, Chris. That was great.
Thank you, Chris. Yes, it was really fun.
And follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We're at Natural Sciences on all three.
Wonderful.
Thank you for listening to Love Nature, the Biophilia Podcast, a production of the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences. You can listen or subscribe at anchor.fm/the Biophilia Podcast, or you can come to our website, naturalsciences.org. You can also visit the museum in beautiful downtown Raleigh. Details on our website.